Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show, Hour 2. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls. This hour, Kyle Mabry was on for Hour Number 1. Our hearts beat roughly every second of our lives, pumping around 74 gallons of blood every hour once we become adults. But the heart is filled with much more than the blood it pumps. It is also the source of a vast supply of stories, reflecting the fact that it has long been a central image for describing those qualities that make us human. In this hour of Focus, we will sample some of these stories as we talk with Stephen Amidon and Thomas Amidon. Stephen Amidon is the author of 6 novels, and Thomas Amidon is a cardiologist, and they are brothers, and they are the co-authors of a recently published book that I think will fascinate a lot of people, and certainly I will recommend it. The title of the book is The Sublime Engine, and the subtitle is A Biography of the Human Heart, and Rodale is the publisher of the book. We're very pleased that both guests could be joining us. Thomas, he makes his home in Kalispell, Montana, and Stephen lives in Massachusetts. They're both with us from opposite coasts by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments certainly welcome. All we ask is people just try to be brief, but of course people want to join in, contribute their thoughts, ask questions. They are certainly welcome. The number, if you are in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us your thoughts by email, you can do that too. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, Stephen Amidon, hello.
Hello, David.
And Thomas.
Hello.
Thanks very much to both of you for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. And I think maybe I'll start with the fiction writer. And I guess I would have said before this that I understood that the heart is a very important metaphor. At least we have so many expressions in English, and I'm sure that they exist in other languages, that involve the heart and its the fact that that's where the human essence lies, and we talk about having a heart-to-heart conversation, and we talk about opening your heart to somebody else, and we talk about, you know, people who have grit and courage and determination as people who have a lot of heart. Well, we could go on all day with that kind of stuff, but I guess I didn't really appreciate how important this is. Maybe as a writer, that was an appreciation you had.
Well, I mean, I had a sense of it when we started talking about the book and working on it, but really, it wasn't until I got my hands into researching it that I realized how pervasive the metaphor has been really since the beginning of written language, and that right from the time of the Egyptians, people saw the heart as not just the animating physical part of the body, but also, as you say, the repository of our humanity. And the Egyptians in 2,000-3,000 years ago were talking about the heart as the way we participated in eternity, that the beating of our heart mimicked or represented the flow of the Nile and the movement of the heavens. And then right through till today, right through till Keith Haring's sort of his heart paintings and I Heart New York and all of that, it's really been the most essential metaphor for describing our humanity.
I guess here I'll talk to, maybe I'll turn with to Dr. Tom, and as one thinks about why it is that people would attach such a significance to this organ, I guess, and this is also something that maybe I hadn't really thought about before, it seems to be that of all of the organs, really the heart is the only one you can feel working.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that's a big part of it. Certainly before we had any understanding of physiology, you could feel your heart racing in your chest when you were excited. You could actually feel your pulse. You were aware of it. I think Stephen tries to make a point of that really in the introduction to the book, that even Neanderthal man was probably aware of this beating sensation, whereas you're not really aware of most of your other organs. You don't feel your spleen or your liver working. And, the brain is maybe a little bit different with your awareness of consciousness, but there isn't a physical sensation. with the brain like there is with the heart. I think the other thing that has caused fascination with the heart in particular is the understanding that the heart, when it stops functioning, leads to sudden death. And I think that, that part of the fascination with the symbol of the heart in life and love and emotion is also the symbol of the heart in sudden death.
Well, how at what point do you think, though, that it's one thing to say that, to understand that this heart beats and that when people are dead, it stops. It's another thing to really understand that somehow the heart stopping can lead to death. At what point did people really understand that distinction, do you think?
I think I'll let Stephen take that first from the kind of literary standpoint. I can answer that medically, but I think you're getting kind of at the role of the heart as not just the pump that supplies blood to the other organs, but more this life force. And certainly, Stephen, you came across a lot of that looking at really the ancient and medieval literature.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the first people to really associate, you know, to understand that the stopping of the heart was the cause of death were the Greeks. And, you know, you see in the Iliad in particular, but also in Greek literature, the idea that, you know, the heart is associated with the humanity and the bravery and the courage of someone like Achilles, and that the heart stopping really is the end of those qualities in the person. However, you know, one of the fascinating things I learned about when looking at the heart was how, and Tom can talk about this, you know, kind of specifically, but how late in the game the physical, physiological understanding of the heart really was. I mean, people didn't really know and understand circulation of the heart until 1620 when Sir William Harvey, you know, finally explained it. And this is 2,000 years after people had been experimenting and looking and thinking about the heart. And then again, it really wasn't until, you know, the 20th century that people really understood how you died, you know, when your heart stopped. So, you know, that was one of the things that I think has perpetuated the fascination with the heart through the ages is this kind of lag between people thinking all the time and talking and looking at the heart and then really understanding how it worked. So, you know, there's a disconnect between understanding the heart is the source of our life and understanding, you know, exactly how it is the source of our life, how it functions in the body.
Yeah, that I think it's interesting that going back to the Greeks, certainly, and maybe even further back, they knew that the heart was important, and it got their attention. And yet, the guy who it's Harvey, this guy who officially gets the credit for discovering that blood circulates and that the heart is the pump. And it seems rather remarkable that given the fact that people going back a long way thought the heart was really important and that it was going was important and when it stopped that was important, but yet didn't put that together with the idea that, well, here's this very important fluid and when it all leaks out and goes away, you're in trouble, and that the heart is the thing that keeps it going. Why did it take thousands of years to put those two things together?
The great British historian and Dr. Jonathan Miller, who did a great series on the human body on BBC years ago, really had a fascinating explanation for that. He said that, and we're talking about metaphors here, Harvey, because he lived in a time when the pump, when actually, you know, there were the first fire engine pumps, you know, and pumps were getting water out of the ground and so forth, that it wasn't really until pumps became part of science, of technology, that he really had a metaphor for thinking about how the heart worked. So I think the other great barrier to understanding the heart as a pump in circulation was the church's interdiction against anatomy, against anatomizing bodies. It really wasn't until the Renaissance that doctors and anatomists were allowed to cut into the human body and look at it and experiment on it. I think it was in the 15th century that an Italian anatomist actually opened the first patient's body in a scientific way. So you know, there was a great deal of guesswork, of superstition that went on, and I think that was a real barrier to understanding you know, until the 17th century to really understanding the circulation of the blood.
Hmm. Well, if I'm sure again that there was this early on, there was this understanding that if you opened a person's veins and you drained their blood out, they would die. So clearly this was something important. But what again, you go back before Harvey, what did people think that the blood was for? And if it didn't circulate, what did they think was happening with it?
They thought that what happened basically was that the blood was created in the stomach or the liver. It was then moved up to the heart through a large vein, which they could see, and then the heart pumped it out to the organs and to the muscles, which used it up. So it was like irrigating a field, you will. And that was really what people believed, was that there was no return of the blood to the heart. That was, and Harvey actually, who was really one of the most underappreciated geniuses of our species. You know, did a couple of simple experiments to figure this out. First, he just took a pencil and paper and said, "Wait, this doesn't make sense. You know, your body would explode if this happened after a couple hours. You just could not. You know, you could not use up that much blood." And the other one was he put his thumb on a vein in his arm and just figured out by moving it back and forth that blood was actually flowing back. So, you know, I think again, it was really the operative metaphor for it was more of a, you know, kind of irrigation than a pump.
Mm. Well, I suppose that makes sense that we're always looking for metaphors, and so you reach for the metaphor that you have. And so if you're an agricultural society, maybe that's going to be your metaphor. And once you get to having mechanical devices, that's going to be your metaphor. And then, you know, once you come up with the idea of running fluids through pipes, well, maybe that's going to be your metaphor. So you're going to grab what's there.
Precisely, yes.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again the two guests. Stephen Amidon, he is the author of 6 novels. His fiction has been published in 15 countries, and he is the co-author, along with his brother, Dr. Thomas Amidon, who is a cardiologist in Kalispell, Montana. They're the co-authors of the book The Sublime Engine, A Biography of the Human Heart. Rodale Press is the publisher on the book, and it's got a lot of really interesting stories about how it is that people over time have thought about the heart and what it was for and what it did and why it was that it was important. And when it stopped, you were in trouble. All of this is in the book, and questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have a caller here I'm going to get to in a second. But one of the things I'm just curious about, and I don't know if this is too goofy a question, but I'm wondering about in a physical sense, the centrality of the heart, the fact that it is where it is, and whether you think that, and maybe I'll direct the question to the doctor first, whether you think that if the heart was located where the kidneys are, it was in a different place, it was not physically central, that we would accord it as much significance.
I think that the heart being located in the center of the chest or just left center of the chest probably adds to the mystique and the lore of the heart. It is really at the core of your being, so to speak. It's not in a peripheral limb. It's not on the fringes. You know, one can make the same argument about the brain, but I think that part of the mystique and part of the lore that is that it is central to your being, and I think that's a good point. You know, one of the things that we were talking about earlier was how primitive our notion of the heart and of cardiac physiology was prior to William Harvey. It's interesting that we're, you know, speaking on Illinois Public Radio, and that it was exactly 100 years ago that a physician from Chicago really advanced our modern understanding of heart disease. James Herrick was a physician in Oak Park, Illinois, and published an article in 1912, 100 years ago, explaining that heart attacks were caused by a blood clot clogging the coronary arteries, something that all of us just take for granted these days as common knowledge. And yet, 100 years ago, that was a novel concept. And in fact, we didn't really even recognize that as the cause of heart disease and utilize that knowledge as a way to treat heart attacks until some 60 or 70 years later. And so even our modern understanding of the physiology of heart disease is striking when you think that it was just 100 years ago that we understood that a blood clot clogging a coronary artery is what leads to the most common cause of death in this country.
Well, I have several callers here. Let's bring some folks into the conversation, and we will start with somebody in Champaign, and they are on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had one question. I don't know how much this is going to actually be on topic, but you had mentioned about the history of them finding out that blood actually circulated instead of it just like irrigating the system. And I was curious that along with that history of when this all was figured out, where did bloodletting fit in? And the location of where they did bloodletting, was this before they realized there was circulation, and or was it after? And did that have anything to do with where they chose the location to do the bloodletting?
Well, bloodletting, yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. This is Stephen. Bloodletting has a fascinating history in that up until Harvey's time, really starting with the Greeks, and we actually talk about this a bit in the book, letting of blood, putting leeches or actually making small cuts on people's veins was probably the primary way of treating disease in the West, and in other cultures also. And the idea being that blood contained humors, and that if too many of these humors, as they were known, accumulated in one part of the body, that you could then let them out, and it would be like, you know, it would be like abscessing, draining an abscess now. And so that was hugely important. Harvey basically didn't end the practice, but he really made it kind of immediately obsolete, because if you think about it, if blood is circulating through the body, then letting it out in one part or the other of the body makes no sense. And so in terms of location, people who still believed in bloodletting after Harvey had no reason to let blood out of the left arm or the right ankle or the kidney area or whatever, because it was going all over the place. So, but I mean, ultimately, the discovery of the circulation of the blood really put this practice to an end. But this practice was huge beforehand. I mean, I think unless you study it, you don't realize that basically if you went to a doctor in 1316 with a complaint, you were going to get a leech put on you, I mean, one way or the other. And, you better be ready for that. And, nowadays, of course, it's become probably something that people in sort of, you know, boutique sort of, kind of practices will do, but it isn't something kind of seen by the mainstream as being worthwhile.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right,
My pleasure.
You. Yes. Excellent question. Let's go to Savoy next, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Are either of you gentlemen familiar with a place called the Heart Math Institute in Colorado?
I'm not, Tom.
No.
Okay, well, they claim that the heart is actually a part of the brain and has right, quite important neurological consequences, but if you're not familiar with it, I guess you can't comment on it.
I think Tom can, actually. We've talked about this a bit.
Okay.
Tom, can you?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the institute that you refer to, but certainly the interactions between the heart and the brain are intricate, and we're learning more about them every day. We know that the heart can beat on its own, independent of the brain. The heart has its own electrical system that allows for it to contract, 2 billion times in your life. And yet there is a very rich interaction between the brain, the nervous system, and the heart. There are two parts of the nervous system. One is called the sympathetic nervous system, which is basically driven by adrenaline, and it's what causes your heart to speed up. It causes your blood pressure to rise when you're excited or frightened or exercising. And then there is the parasympathetic part of the nervous system, which is, I like to refer to that as the kind of anti-adrenaline part of the nervous system. And these two parts of the nervous system are in balance with one another, the yin and the yang, if you will, that control heart rate. And there are all kinds kinds of very important aspects of daily life and of your health and medicine, where this interaction between the brain and the heart is pivotal. I'll see folks regularly who are complaining of feeling an abnormal heartbeat, a palpitation. And sometimes the palpitation is a dangerous rhythm disturbance, and sometimes it's really just more of a nuisance disturbance. And if I look at that patient and do some simple testing and determine that the palpitations they're feeling is a nuisance rather than a danger, one of the things that I'll recommend is a vigorous exercise program. And the reason for that is that the more that you exercise, the more the parasympathetic part of your nervous system will predominate, the anti-adrenaline part of your nervous system, and it'll tend to suppress these extra beats and slow the heart rate down. If you look at highly conditioned athletes, when Lance Armstrong was winning the Tour de France, when Bjorn Borg was winning Wimbledon, they had pulse rates in the high 30s, low 40s, and yet they felt perfectly fine. This is because of that interaction between the brain and the heart. It's the parasympathetic part of the nervous system taking over, and we think that's a very healthy thing.
The other thing that I guess makes me think of, though, when you talk about the brain and the heart, is the idea that we have, and apparently this is an idea that goes back a long way, that the heart is the place of feeling. That's where emotion is. That the head, the brain, is the place of thinking. That's where the rational stuff goes on, and that these are two different things, and they're in two different places. And that placing them that way, that is an idea that goes back a long way. And I think we still have that sense that there are competing centers for this, and that they in fact, those two things are emotions and are the rational part of us, mm-hmm, are in competition.
Yeah, and 20th century, this is the doctor talking again. 20th century psychiatry and neurology would argue that the rational part of our being and the emotional part of our being are probably more properly both situated in the brain. And yet, even in 21st century, we see examples where it may not be quite that simple. And I'll give you a couple. There were two studies that were done about 10 years ago that looked at rates of heart attack. And in this particular case, they looked in the Los Angeles area, and then they also looked in Japan, in Kobe, Japan. And they looked at rates of heart attack in the 5 days following the Northridge earthquake and the Kobe earthquake. And then they looked at the rates of heart attack exactly a year earlier, and saw that there was a substantial increase in the number of people either dying suddenly or having heart attacks after the emotional trauma of living through an earthquake. Now, I lived in San Francisco in 1989 during the Loma Prieta earthquake, and I can testify that it's an absolute terrifying thing to survive, because it's so unexpected and so kind of immediately traumatic. And what we saw in these studies were that the heart attack rates in the 4 or 5 days following a major earthquake go up substantially, again, kind of pointing out this interaction between emotion, extreme emotion, and heart disease. We see other examples of that. There's a syndrome that the Japanese described where emotional traumas can actually trigger heart attacks, similar to what happened after the earthquakes. And I'll see this probably once a month or so, where a patient will come in for all the world looking like they're having a heart attack. They have chest pain. Their EKG looks like a heart attack. We measure enzymes in the blood to look for heart damage, and they're elevated. We look at how the wall of the heart is functioning, and it's not moving. Everything looks like a standard heart attack where you would expect to find a clogged artery. And we'll rush the patient off to the catheterization lab and take a picture of their coronary arteries, and they're wide open. And if you go back and talk with the person, invariably there will have been some emotional trauma that triggered the event. I had a patient last month where this exact thing happened. And when I talked to her, what immediately preceded the onset of this pseudo heart attack was that she had run out to the store briefly. She'd left her husband at home, who had Alzheimer's disease. She never does that because she's concerned about him. But this was just going to be a 5-minute trip to the local market, and she locked her keys in her car, and so she just had a panic attack, thinking, "I've got to get home. I've got to get home." And this actually triggered what, for all the world, looked like a heart attack, and yet her arteries were wide open. So we still see these kind of mysterious examples of emotion and a physiologic response, a heart attack, and we don't quite understand that.
Yeah. Let me go on here, too. Maybe I want to come back to this head-heart thing with the writer, but we have some callers here, so rather than make them wait, let's go on again, and we'll talk next with someone in Indiana on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question that's very personal because it just happened to me. I coded when I was at a hospital and my heart stopped, and luckily everybody was doing what they were supposed to be doing, and a nurse named Jim grabbed me, did CPR, and brought me back. Through the ordeal and all that, I forgot to ask this question. How much time do you have when your heart stops for a person to, since bring you back through whatever means, before you've done some ultimate damage either to the brain or the heart itself, I guess?
Well, that's a doctor question.
That's a doctor question, and I'll answer that one. It sounds like they did a great response, and you recovered completely, which is fantastic. The brain is very sensitive to any cutoff in blood and oxygen supply. And, you know, we can see if someone has a cardiac arrest that's not witnessed and CPR is not started immediately, you can begin to see effects on brain function literally within minutes.
Hmm.
And that's why we see defibrillators all over the place now. It's why people are trained in CPR, in bystander CPR. In fact, the latest information on CPR for folks who are a little squeamish about doing mouth-to-mouth breathing, if you just do chest compressions, you're getting most of the benefit of CPR. And so people should not fail to do CPR if they see someone collapse because of the concern about doing mouth-to-mouth or getting a communicable disease, which is a negligible concern in most cases anyway. But you know, compressing on the center of the chest about 100 times a minute, if you just do that, you're going to help the patient. Now, there are extreme examples where we see people have cardiac arrest and actually survive brain function. One is, again, pertinent in Illinois this time of year, and that is people who have a cardiac arrest in extreme cold or in cold water submersion. Cooling down the body can actually help preserve brain function. And you'll hear at times about miraculous recoveries of people that have been in a frozen lake for 20 or 30 minutes, and they're resuscitated and recover. And in fact, we use that now when a patient comes in with an unwitnessed arrest and we don't know that CPR was started immediately. If we're able to jumpstart the heart and we're concerned about brain function, we'll actually cool that patient down. You know, normal body temperature is about 37 degrees centigrade. We'll cool them down to about 30, 31 degrees and leave them at that temperature for 24 to 48 hours. In a cold drug-induced coma, and we found that actually helps preserve and restore brain function after cardiac arrest.
Well, thank you. As far as I can tell, though, some of my relatives questioned that I didn't seem to have any problem with my brain function. The guy caught it at the right time. I guess everything was just a fantastic hospital, I must say that.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, we're talking this morning in this hour with Stephen and Thomas Amidon. They are the co-authors of The Sublime Engine, a biography of the human heart. We'll continue to talk. Take some more calls in just a moment. We'll take a short break first. This is Focus.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, 3 blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House Catering can tailor a menu and price for events from corporate box lunches to weddings, business meetings, and other special events. More information is available at 365-8004.
This is This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. If you do that, you'll find out tomorrow we'll be talking about security in outer space. What are some of the national and international challenges involved? And we'll be talking with Bharath Gopalaswamy. He is Associate Director of the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security at the U of I. Also joining us for the show will be Victoria Sampson, a senior analyst with the Center for Defense Information. Then in the second hour, we'll have an interesting story for you. We will talk with the author of a new book that's titled The Ice Balloon. Alec Wilkinson is his name. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. And this is the story of a Swedish explorer, a man named Solomon André, who in 1897 set out to discover the North Pole by flying over it in a hydrogen balloon. That's the story, and that's what we'll do tomorrow. We're here again weekday mornings. You can check the schedule by going to willillinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Stephen Amidon and Thomas Amidon. Stephen Amidon is a writer. He's the author of 6 novels, and Thomas Amidon is a cardiologist. He lives in Montana. Stephen lives in Massachusetts. Together, they are the co-authors of the book The Sublime Engine, A Biography of the Human Heart, and it is published by Rodale Press. It first came out in hardcover last year. It has just last month come out in paperback, so you can look out, go out and look for the book, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I just want to mention, you know, before I came into the studio to talk with the two of you, I was looking at some material about this the story that I'm going to do tomorrow about the man who tried to fly over the North Pole in a balloon, which was not successful. But the thing that got me thinking of you guys, and I'm sure that Stephen will like this, is the story is that this poor man who died in the attempt, his fiance, when she died, requested that the ashes of her heart be buried with her fiancé. And well, I liked that a lot.
Yeah, I mean that's you know, I'm that's something that's you really see throughout the history of the heart, is people's belief in the heart as kind of almost like a fetish or a talisman. You know, from the Egyptians, when the only part of the body that wasn't that was kind of the only organ that was really looked after during the process of mummification was the heart. The brain was sort of tossed away as the sort of useless lump of fat, but the heart was actually put into a, you know, it was seen as the thing that would ascend to heaven if one had been virtuous, where it would then be, you know, its essence would be weighed on this cosmic scale, and if it was heavy with sin and transgression, you would go to their equivalent of Hades, and then if it was light with righteousness, you would go to the fields of heaven. And you know, there, throughout history, there are stories of hearts being treated as something that preserves, that outlives the person. I mean, you know, crusaders' hearts will be brought back from the Levantine during the Crusades, and you know, I think Richard Lionheart's heart was actually brought back to England. They sewed it into an ox. A live ox, and then drove the ox all the way back from France to England to keep it kind of not alive, but to keep it from rotting. Mm-hmm. And in the Middle Ages, if someone was believed to be a saint, we talk about this in the book, this was the only kind of anatomy that was allowed, was that, especially with nuns, if they were believed to be saints, their hearts were actually removed and examined for relics, for signs of crosses or the image of Jesus or what you will. And then, you know, famously, the poet Shelley, when he died, when he drowned in Italy, he was, you know, because there was the plague going on, and his body was cremated on the beach. Lord Byron was there. And famously, his heart did not burn. That you know, that was the only part of his body that would not burn. And it was actually an adventurer. Who was with Byron, took it and gave it to Mary Shelley and presented it to her. And accounts say that she wasn't quite thrilled with that. She'd just finished writing Frankenstein a year earlier, and I think she probably had it with that sort of thing. But she kept Shelley's heart, you know, with her until the day she died. And then there's an apocryphal story, I don't know if it's true, that someone presented Thomas Hardy's wife with his heart after he died, and the family dog ate it. I don't know if that's true. That certainly is a rumor that you hear. Wow. So, So, yes, I mean, that's not uncommon at all that someone would want, you know, the heart and not some other part of the anatomy as a memento, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I think it also does point, it's interesting that, again, it gets back to this idea that if you really want to see the person's essence, you look into their heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that it seems to be that that's also ends up being the seat of spirituality or somehow the thing that, you know, whatever the deity is, that's the thing that connects you to the deity. It's, you know, more than any other part that it is the heart.
Yes, and this was, you know, this continues to this day. I mean, if you go to any church and just about any religion, people will talk about, you know, the heart is how you understand God. You don't have a rational, your primary understanding of the Lord, of spiritual matters, is not rational like your understanding of algebra or what you will. It really is something that's intuitive and located in the heart. Of course, in the Middle Ages, this was as I mentioned, this was taken to an extreme of people thinking that the heart was literally the place in your body where Jesus Christ and dwelled, and that, you know, again, you know, we talk in the book about Sister Chiara, a 14th century Italian nun, who actually they found what they believed to be a crucifix with the image of Christ on it in her heart. And, you know, Tom sort of has a theory that it may have been something a little more easily explained than that, you know, that it may have been, you know, have a physiological explanation. But yes, I mean, I think that there's, even to this day, and we still, you know, in the book I talk about, it's perfectly sensible that somebody who's received a heart transplant or an artificial heart could let's say they receive an artificial heart, could turn to their surgeon after the operation and say, "I thank you from the bottom of my heart." Mm. And, you know, which is literally a nonsensical statement, but yet everybody understands what they mean.
Well, I tell you, we have some other callers here, and we'll go back to them and see what's on their minds and start again in with line number one. We'll take them in the order they came in. The first person here is in Kankakee. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thank you. Very thoughtful show. Just a couple of comments and maybe an experience. You're just talking about the heart. As it relates to religion, I was raised Catholic in Chicago, and I can remember, of course, one of the famous organizations was the Sacred Heart of Jesus. It was a club, an organization. I'm not really sure what its function was, but I remember seeing statues and this kind of radiated light coming out of the heart of a statue of Jesus. So that's pretty much right on. But the example I was going to draw on is in literature. You could mention somebody of being large-hearted, this kind of a thing, a big heart. And, of course, that would mean generosity and kindness and humanity, whereas in the real world, an athlete or anybody else, you could die of an enlarged heart. You know, so many times athletes, you know, that they'll die earlier than they should because of all the exercise, what have you. So there's kind of a comparison between those two statements. But personally, about 20, 25 years ago, my brother passed away. He was 42. He was a heavy smoker. He died of a blood clot in his lung. But I can tell you, they'll tell you that a passing of a sibling will affect you more dramatically than almost anything because it brings your own mortality to bear. And I really thought that I was next. You know, I went through some very difficult periods, anxiety, you know, fight or flee type of thing where, you know, if I exercised, my heart was racing up, that's it, you know. And so it does play, your emotions do play a huge role on your physical attributes and where your mind is. So I wanted to share that, and I'll leave that to your guests to comment any way they want.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Just quickly, and then we'll go on to the Sacred Heart image. Actually, was a vision that Margaret Mary Alacoque, I think, believe her name, a sister had, and of the beating heart of Jesus, and it became sort of the kind of one of the signature emblems of the Catholic Church, and that happened, I think, in the 18th century. So yes, I'm glad he mentioned that. That is, you know, it's hard to think of the Catholic religion without this image of the Sacred Heart. If I might, let me just comment on the last thing he said about a death in the family. One of the inspirations for this book, I guess I should say, was that Our father died in 2001 of heart disease. He was a long time. You know, he'd had bypass surgery in the 80s, and was always sort of after that somebody who was a heart patient. And you know, was fortunate enough to have a wonderful cardiologist for a son, and that I think helped him a lot. But you know, that was something that kind of went into the making of this book, I think, on both of our parts, is that, I mean, Tom obviously is going to be aware of his heart because he's a cardiologist. But after that, you know, I really became aware of the fragility of the heart, of how, of all your organs, it's really the one that you can tend to. You can nurture your heart. You know, you can exercise it. You can eat well. You know, people, when they eat well, aren't really thinking about their livers or their kidneys and you know, and when they exercise, they're not really about thinking about strengthening, you know, their spleen or their pancreas. It really is the heart is seen. I think this goes into the humanity of it again, is the one part of our body that we can really improve, that we can really look after, that we can almost be like a parent to or a good friend to. Mm. So I'm glad he mentioned that because, you know, watching someone close to you have difficulties with their heart really will affect that.
Well, Tom, anything you would want to add to that?
Yeah, I would. I would add a couple of things. One of probably the most obvious symbol of the heart is coming up next week, Valentine's Day, and we're usually asked about Saint Valentine, and I defer to Stephen because he knows that story better than I. But I'll admit that I take full advantage of Valentine's Day in my medical practice. For the past 15 years, we've used February as a forum for doing public awareness in heart disease. We did this when I was in Seattle for 15 years, and I'm doing it now in Kalispell, where we invite in the public, and we've gotten great responses because there is such an interest in heart health. And we talk about all the things that people can do to identify heart disease. Certainly family history, as our caller mentioned, is a potent risk factor for heart disease, but also a very potent motivator. You know, having seen our dad succumb to heart disease, I completely understand what he's talking about with his brother, and you know, I try to make use of that in a kind way to get people motivated about thinking about their heart and their health. And then we also use the forum to talk about all the other risk factors that we have control over: diet, exercise, smoking, blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes. In fact, the kind of catchphrase these days is "know your numbers." You know, each one of those variables that contributes to heart disease has a set of numbers associated with them, and our job from a public awareness standpoint is to get people to know their numbers. You know, have you checked your blood pressure? Have you checked your cholesterol? Have you checked for diabetes, et cetera? And I guess I'm completely guilty of exploiting the symbolism of Valentine's Day to get people to think about that. And it's been very well received and very gratifying to do those types of programs.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of other callers here. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Just let me quickly introduce again. The last person you heard, that's Thomas Amidon. He's a cardiologist. He lives in Montana. His brother, Stephen Amidon, is a novelist. He lives in Massachusetts. The two of them are with us this morning, and we are talking about their book, The Sublime Engine, A Biography of the Human Heart. Rodale is the publisher, and it just came out in January in paper, if you'd like to read it. Other callers are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and we'll go back here to someone in Urbana, here where we are, line two. Hello.
Yes. There is a condition that arises apparently most often among the Hill people of Vietnam, the Hmong. They have apparently horrific nightmares, and will die apparently of a fright-induced heart attack. Apparently this condition also is seen occasionally in Japan and elsewhere. I believe there was one instance of a young woman in this country, as well as among the Hmong in this country. Do you know much about this?
Well, maybe we'll go to Dr. Tom.
Stephen, you looked into this a little bit. Do you want to talk about it first, and then I'll talk about the medicine?
Yes. I mean, they're actually, I'm really glad you brought that up. It's a fascinating a part of the lore of the heart is that, as the caller described, that among certain people, it's in the Laos, the Hmong people, but also in the Philippines. There's actually they've named it deity. They're actually has many names in different cultures. There actually is a goddess, a kind of or anti goddess, who will appear to young men in the night, and they will die, and the symptoms of the death are, if that's the word, are sudden cessation of the heart. And because there's no rational explanation for it, these are healthy young men with no signs of illness, that and it happens during the night, that a mythology has grown up that there is this goddess who appears to them and just literally scares them to death. And so what happened was I believe they were French researchers in the 60s, started looking into this. And I think Tom can take it from here about what the physiology of what's going on is.
Well, yeah, and again, a great question and a fascinating topic. And it really leads into the broader question of sudden death in otherwise young people. And we're beginning to understand the physiology. The heart is more than just a pump. It's a very sophisticated organ. There's the whole electrical system of the heart is fascinating to study, but the electrical activity of the heart has to do with the movement of different charged ions across membranes, mostly sodium and potassium and calcium. And what we have found is that there are hereditary forms of sudden death where the channels that allow these charged molecules to move across membranes in the heart are faulty. And in fact, the sudden death amongst the Hmong is probably now what we call Brugada syndrome, named after two cardiologists that first described it. And again, it's a devastating phenomenon. There's probably at least 7 or 8 or 9 different genetic variations that we now understand where either the sodium channels or the potassium channels are faulty, and it's inherited. And not all of the cases are associated with fright. Some happen with exercise, some happen at rest. But they all share a common link in that the death is usually sudden, completely unheralded, and in young people. And one of the very important things that we stress is that if there is a family history of sudden, unexpected death, we're very aggressive about looking at siblings or children for any signs that they may be at risk. And these days, probably the best treatment for someone who is at risk is to actually give them an implanted defibrillator so that if their heart does fibrillate unexpectedly, this device can detect it and deliver a shock automatically.
Okay, let's take another caller here. I want to thank the last person and go to Lovington here, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Within the last, about a month, I read an article in a local paper here about a broken heart syndrome. I think the study was done in Japan, and they more or less correlated it to death, or death in the family. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. Have you heard of it?
Tom, let me take this first, and then you can go.
Sure.
Of course, people have talked about dying of broken heart for a long time, and in Jacobean drama, you would literally have people dropping dead left and right from broken hearts, and so there's a great long tradition of dying of a broken heart in literature and in history, and I think one of the things that's interesting from a medical point of view, and I'll turn it over to my brother in a minute, is that these things are often accompanied by either tremendous depression. King Lear is an example of somebody who just has this broken heart, or sudden shock. And now, as we come into the 21st century, we understand stress. The stress is a killer, and stress is a terrible has a terrible effect on the heart often. And that if you look at some of the great sort of people who died of broken hearts in literature and in history. A rather more cold and calculating way of talking about them is to say they just suffered from depression and stress, and this took a toll on the heart. So, Tom, I'll turn it over to you there.
Sure, and the broken heart syndrome that you're referring to, the Japanese actually did first describe about 10, 12 years ago, and they actually called it Takotsubo syndrome. Takotsubo is the Japanese term for squid trap. And what happens, this is the kind of pseudo heart attack that I was talking about earlier in the hours, an extreme emotional stress, and a death of a loved one is a good example of that, can lead to a syndrome that looks just like a heart attack. And of course, with about a third of heart attacks, people just drop dead suddenly. And that's what the broken heart syndrome is. The term that we now use is stress cardiomyopathy. The reason the Japanese called it takotsubo is that if patients present with this type of broken heart syndrome and survive, if we take a picture of their heart at the time that it's happening, there's a whole segment of the heart that's not moving. In fact, it's actually ballooning the wrong way. And apparently the heart has the shape and configuration of an old Japanese squid trap. It's a kind of a fascinating and lyrical name, but we've gotten away from takotsubo and now call it stress cardiomyopathy. But it's a well recognized phenomenon.
Well, there is so much. I say that sometimes when we come to the end of the show. Too bad we can't keep going. Well, in this case, really, it is too bad we can't keep going. So there's so many other things we could talk about here. A lot of fascinating stories, and I'm sure we could do a little more cardiology as well. But we're going to have to stop at this point, I am sorry to say, with the recommendation that if you would like to read more about the heart and its meaning, you can look for this book that we have been talking about. The title is The Sublime Engine, A Biography of the Human Heart. It's published by the Rodale Press. It's it came out first last year in hardcover, and the last month came out in paper. So you can look for it in the bookstore by our guests, Stephen Amidon. He's a novelist, and Thomas Amidon. He is a cardiologist. And we'd say, Steve, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
And Tom, thank you.
Thank you, David.